Okay, hour number two. I'm Jeff Rentz. Glad you're along tonight. Thanks for being here. I'm very honored to have back with us again Webster Griffin Tarpley, talking about his new book, which is on the way. You can pre-order right now at info@progressivepress.com. Just write an email to info@progressivepress.com. The book will be called, 9/11 Synthetic Terrorism Made in the USA. All right, and we concluded that last hour, Webster, with the idea that GCHQ in London knows
actually, it's a place called Cheltenham.
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 Okay, and that's a fact that I'll bet less than a fraction of a percent of Americans know anything about.
Well, you have these Anglo-American intelligence sharing agreements
right.
And signals intelligence sharing agreements.
Well, I remember when they were signed, there were little notices about them years ago, and one said, oh, okay, big deal, they're friends. But they didn't understand the depth and the completeness of the sharing.
The British get it all automatically. The Israelis have to get out there and purloin it. But the British get everything automatically.
Just about as fast as I imagine.
Pardon me?
Just about as fast as I imagine.
I think it's real time. In other words, whatever is known at the NSA
right.
in Fort Meade is immediately known at GCHQ.
I meant the Israelis going out to steal it. They can get it just about as fast with the network they have. But you know.
I'm sure they keep up. But when, for example, Claire Short was in the British government, she was the overseas development minister, and she was getting the reports on the bugging of Kofi Annan's phone and telephone conversations
yeah.
and so forth. That could have been, you know, the British, the U.S., it could have been the two of them together. I think this really is a big one because if you look, one of the things I try to describe is the Patsy milieu in London, Finsbury Mosque, Brixton Mosque. This is not where you're going to find the highly trained, highly equipped expert professionals who could make 9/11 happen. But what you do find there are these Patsies. Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, a very pathetic case, somebody who was, he probably qualified as mentally retarded,
correct.
Had been living in the mosque, had no visible
yeah.
means of support. So we have these unscrupulous characters who run it. And the British government was very accommodating. They let these imams go into the British jails and recruit among Muslim prisoners there, among desperate, you know, hopeless people.
Mm-hmm.
Who could then get something meaning for their lives by becoming patsies. In the late 1990s, I give a list in the book of the various terrorist organizations that were on the U.S. State Department terrorist list. And I give about 6 to 8 of them had headquarters in London, and another probably a dozen or so had operations in London. And it included somebody like this Zawahiri, right, the guy who is now supposedly Bin Laden's number two man, is thought to be, I would say, an MI6 agent who tells Bin Laden what to do. In other words, he's sort of the Cheney of the two, if we can compare Bin Laden to Bush in the sense that he's somebody who doesn't really know very
right.
much of what he's doing, but he reads what's put in front of him.
Uh-huh.
Zawahiri had been involved in the killing of Sadat, and Jehan Sadat, the widow of the former president of Egypt, who had been killed back in the early 80s,
mm-hmm.
Complained on television after 9/11 that she had been trying to get this Zawahiri extradited back to Egypt, and the British would not give him up.
Wow.
Bin Laden is said to have had the reports vary, an apartment, a villa, a home of some sort in Wembley, which is a suburb of London, and he had it as a kind of a pied-à-terre, right, an apartment
mm-hmm.
that he, or a residence mm-hmm. that he could use when he needed it.
Mm-hmm.
The London London Daily Telegraph, which is a kind of a right-wing paper of the Hollinger Group, put out a story saying, you know, the capital of Great Britain is the home to a bewildering variety of Islamic fundamentalist groups. London is the world capital of Islamic fundamentalism. It qualifies as Londonistan, according to another source at the time. So if you look at the British know the Middle East better than anybody. They ruled it. And with half of these countries we're talking about, they created.
Not only ruled it, I was just going to say they created it. They drew the map in the early part of the last century.
They created it. And I guess maybe this brings us to a couple of things we've touched on, this Al-Qaeda bin Laden question.
Mm-hmm. The guy in the cave with the cell phone, yeah.
the cave and the laptop and the cell phone and this raving character. Where can we start? There's a very interesting book that I read as part of the preparation for this, which is called Imperial Hubris, by a guy called Anonymous. And I think I know his name, but his name might not mean anything to people. Mm-hmm. He is an active duty CIA agent in the bowels of the CIA in Langley. He's an analyst. Mm-hmm. And he's gotten permission to put this book out. And it came out 3 or 4 months ago. Imperial Hubris by Anonymous, published by Brassies. The CIA let him write it. They vetted it, and they said, well, there are no secrets, so you have the right to write this book. Fantastic story. Nobody else does this, but Anonymous can. Basically, it's a document of the Bin Laden fan club. He says that Bin Laden is the greatest political genius of the 21st century. He is a world historical figure. He dwarfs political leaders of the Western countries because he believes in something. He is genuinely loved by the masses of the Arab and Islamic world. He compares him to Abraham Lincoln. I think we're getting almost obscene in the praise that he gives from the CIA to Bin Laden. You have to think, what is going on here?
Right.
Notice the BBC just put out a television program on Wednesday night. I don't know if you followed this. It is a story that Al-Qaeda is an illusion. This is a BBC television program, came out last night, and it said that Al-Qaeda is practically non-existent as an organization, but it has become a staple of propaganda in the West.
Right.
It is a dark illusion, they say. It is a myth. That's a word that I like to use for it, too. And they say that the only reason that people pay so much attention to Al-Qaeda is that bankrupt politicians find that their slogans no longer mobilize anybody, and the only way to organize the masses and, above all, keep their own power as politicians is to constantly refer to Al-Qaeda. Now, my chapter on Al-Qaeda is called Al-Qaeda, the CIA Arab Legion. There is no other way to describe it. I try to show in the course of this that when Bin Laden had to move around, he got Sergeant Ali Mohammed from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to be his security man, to be his moving man. We can see that Al-Qaeda operatives in Saudi Arabia were sent to the United States by the U.S. consulates there. Essentially, the State Department was their travel bureau. And the CIA and people like Bernard Lewis of the Institute for Advanced Studies are working as flacks for Bin Laden. There's a very active Bin Laden fan club, I would say, in CIA headquarters, and they're doing everything to build this guy up. And, of course, why? Well, on the one side, you need to have a scary figure for the purposes of your domestic politics, right, for Bush's reelection campaign, although it goes far beyond Bush.
Right. On
the other hand, look at what Bin Laden stands for. He says, we have to recreate the caliphate, meaning we have to destroy every existing Arab government.
Mm-hmm.
I think the CIA is willing to follow him a certain degree of distance down that road.
Mm-hmm.
And Bin Laden also says, if you're a true Muslim and you meet a non-believer, you have to kill that person on the spot. Now, think what it means. If you're in the Arab world or the Islamic world, what's the normal thing that you would do? Well, ally with Europe, ally with Russia, ally with China, ally with India, ally with Japan, ally with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
But if you follow Bin Laden, you can't do any of that. In other words, you've basically isolated yourself. You've guaranteed your own defeat. And I found a neocon commentary from a guy called Killebrew, who seems to hope, this is another, you know, U.S. military intelligence guy, seems to hope that Bin Laden, Al-Qaeda-type movements will take over the government of some Arab countries in the near future. Now, it seems to say, we know that the Arabs are going to hate U.S.-British world domination.
Sure.
All we can do is make sure that they have leaders who will guarantee their defeat, their isolation, their backwardness, and make them anathema to the rest of the world. And that seems to be the function of Al-Qaeda.
Fascinating analysis. Just amazing. And with the kind of Robin Hood mystique he has, and if he's, I don't know any other way to term it except he is an almost unequaled bonanza for the CIA and those who would seek to destroy that culture.
I think it's going to be very interesting. A couple of things that are current.
So they don't want to kill him is the point.
I think that's the question. Does the CIA want to give up an asset of this importance to save a puppet president?
What magnitude
is that? Another puppet president.
Bush is more, in a way, Bush is far more expendable than bin Laden.
I think that may turn out to be the case. And if we get to the U.S. presidential election and they haven't found bin Laden that they could easily find, it indicates that the CIA is more devoted to their long-term patsy than to the fortunes of the likes of Bush.
Amazing. Well, always fascinating when we get together. Webster Griffin Tarpley is here, and we will continue after this. Okay, right back with you. Jeff Francis, Webster Griffin Tarpley. That comment you made, and I haven't seen it yet in any detail. I'm going to be looking for that write-up about the BBC report questioning whether Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda, whatever you want to call it, or however you want to spell it, actually even exists as much more than somebody's intel pipe dream somewhere.
Al-CIA, duh.
Yeah, well said. Yeah.
Look, this is very interesting. This BBC program, Al Qaeda is a myth. Al Qaeda is a dark illusion created by politicians who can't hold on to power any other way. I think this is. I say much more than that in the book, but this is the BBC. That's obviously a kind of a swipe at Bush. But the interesting thing is, what else happened tomorrow when everybody in the world knew that that program was coming out? This character Zarqawi in Iraq, right? Supposedly.
Allegedly in Iraq.
The U.S. claims that this guy is the leader of the resistance. They've promoted him to be the bin Laden of Iraq. Zarqawi comes out and says, I pledge allegiance to bin Laden.
Right.
I'm for bin Laden. Bin Laden is my man. Bin Laden, bin Laden, bin Laden. And it's basically, you have to scratch your head and say, well, my God, this looks like, you know, a public relations operation.
Yeah, who's writing this in Langley?
Right, exactly. Who's writing this stuff in language? So that Zarqawi, I mean, in Iraq, of course, you've got a national resistance. There's no doubt about that. It's real. And somehow on top of that, the CIA seems to be grafting this guy Zarqawi as a figurehead of that, right, to try to do whatever damage they can by promoting this guy, because the real leader is probably not known, or leaders, whatever they are.
Right, and the point is both bin Laden and Zarqawi could be dead. We don't know.
We have no idea. They could be, you know, we could have two or three doubles running around. They could all be dead. They could be a hologram.
Exactly. Could be all of the above. And
could be Max Headroom talking to us. We just don't know.
We don't know.
Interesting is that when you look about people from Saudi Arabia who have known bin Laden and talk about him, this is also in this book, Imperial Hubris, that I looked at. Some people say he's a simpleton. One guy says he's a clueless dupe who never knew that he was working for the CIA in Afghanistan. He thought he was working for Pakistan alone. He thought he was pure.
Wow.
Prince Bandar, the ambassador here in Washington, says, I met him and I didn't think he could lead 8 ducks across the road. And at that point, CIA Anonymous comes in and says, how dare you? This is a genius. This is the Abraham Lincoln of the Arab world. Don't believe it. And he gets very, very angry when people say that Zawahiri is the witting one who does the planning, and bin Laden is just a figurehead or some kind of a windbag who comes out and recites poems. The CIA bin Laden fan club is alive and well in Langley. The CIA is the Al-Qaeda is the CIA Arab Legion. You can look at all the countries where they operated. They tried to kill Gaddafi of Libya. They've been active in Bosnia at the time that was a target, against Serbia. I mean, you can just go down the Anglo-American hit list and find that Al-Qaeda shows up precisely at the proper point, but always with this ideology, oh, we're not working for the U.S. and the British. We're here to create the caliphate, but unfortunately we've got to destroy this or that Arab or Islamic government along the way. So,
for those of you who don't know what caliphate means, it's C-A-L-I-P-H-A-T-E, and it used to be, well, a strong man was the head caliph, and he ran things. It was their little mini dictatorships all over the Arab world is what they were, and the idea was to unify it all into one.
Well, in effect, in the most recent centuries, say up until the end of the First World War, up until about 1919 or 1924, depending on how you count it, the caliph was the sultan, the Turkish sultan,
the
ruler of the Ottoman Empire.
The sick man of Europe.
Right. And of course, Ataturk was the guy who got rid of this. He basically said, "We don't want the Ottoman Empire. We don't want any empire, and we don't want the caliphate. So let's get rid of it."
Wonder who was behind and bankrolling Ataturk.
I think Ataturk is a positive figure. I think he's actually, and I try to go through this too. This is another one of my chapters.
A real modernist, eh?
I'm sorry?
A real modernist, a real man.
Yes, I think he's in many ways an exemplary figure in terms of modernization, in terms of fighting against the backwardness and superstition for economic development. Having been to Turkey a couple of times, I've sort of seen this on the ground. The thing that you can say, and I just give a kind of a brief history of the modern Middle East, and if you look at the basic thesis there, is that if you look at the people who were progressive, who meant something positive, you'll find that they were always opposed tooth and nail by the U.S., the British, the French sometimes, and that the most benighted kinds of fundamentalists, I guess you'd say, have always been promoted because those are people who are not going to make their country strong and united and intelligent. They're not going to be able to make alliances with other Europeans or Russia or Japan or the U.S., whoever it would be at the time. The cases I go through, I mean, Nasser of Egypt, he was a modernizer. The British and U.S. did everything they could to destroy him. Mossadegh in Iran nationalized the oil companies in the 1950s. U.S. and the British overthrew him. Iraq, and a very interesting example, General Qasem, in the late 50s and early 60s, was a kind of a Nasser figure for Iraq. And that's Saddam Hussein got going as an Anglo-American operative.
Well,
he
took him out.
Them.
Right.
And we can, you know, we can just go on and on. You name it.
Very interesting.
Pick one of these countries, and you'll find that the U.S. and the British have been promoting. I mean, the extreme example is this guy, Hekmatyar, in Afghanistan, who is basically one of bin Laden's great friends. You look at him and you say, well, he's a drug pusher, he's an absolute barbarian. And the CIA wanted him because they knew that he would never be able to make a deal with the Russians or the Iranians or anybody else.
Okay. We can't talk too long or at any length about this area without dropping in Russia and Russians. And I still do believe that the Russian role in the months and years ahead may be a shocker to most here in the West. I don't think they're out of it like the media would like us to believe. They're still very potent. So things are going on there. Back in just a minute, we'll pursue that and other issues with Webster Griffin Harper. Continue with Webster Tarpley, his new book, 9/11 Synthetic Terrorism, Made in the USA, due out shortly. You can pre-order it at info@progressivepress.com. I always go back to Russia. For years, Americans thought the Russian Empire was finished with the collapse of the old Soviet Union. Little did they know that 95% or better of the KGB continued as usual, nothing new there. The rise of the oligarchs, of course, the majority of whom, 7 of 8, as I understand it, are Israeli or of Jewish origin, and their tie-in with the neocon ethic, if not the Rothschilds directly, and so forth. The struggle between Russian nationalists, the oligarchs, the KGB, the factions, Putin coming on now. It's a very big game going on there, a very important game, especially when you look at what's happening in Chechnya and in Georgia. I mean, the U.S. is blatantly endeavoring to foment a major war in Georgia. The so-called rebels in Georgia are supported by the Russians. This is remarkable, and the Pristina event, again, is, I think, a pivotal issue, and one tries to grab onto this and understand it. I'd like to hear you talk a little bit more about Russia, their advanced weapon systems. They have allegedly never slowed a bit their development of the most advanced weapons they can come up with, a research and development by and large paid for with money from the West, of course, diverted funds and so forth. But they're not stupid. They, in fact, had the American administration agree to pay for the dismantling and the removal, shall we say, of the, many of their aging nuclear submarines because they say they were broke, couldn't do it. Very smart games going on there. How do you see the Russian future? And I still say they're a very dangerous, in terms of a threat to the powers that be over here, enterprise.
I would see the Russians as essentially in a defensive posture, which is where they usually can be found.
And when you back someone in a corner, though, they become dangerous.
Right. That they know that they're under attack. You have to remember, at the beginning of the 1990s, the effect of the shock therapy was essentially to destroy the society. It's a very interesting case. If you look at Weimar Germany, Germany in the 1930s, the middle class was destroyed twice, once by the hyperinflation of 1923, and then again by the deflation or depression of 1929 to 1933. And, and according to any number of German writers of the time, the thing that made the German people ripe for Hitler was the fact that the middle class had been destroyed twice. This was a kind of an indispensable precondition. Well, if you look at Russia, they've been destroyed twice, too. Once in a bout of hyperinflation in 1991-92, shock therapy, ruining the middle class. And then 1998, the state bankruptcy with a banking panic loaded on top of that.
So very interesting.
That was the bracketing sort of the Yeltsin era. Of course, he's the one who sent tanks to shoot up the parliament. And the people in there were not necessarily red, brown, you know, communist, fascist elements, but there were a lot of, I think, relatively decent people in there. The U.S., of course, supported him shooting up the parliament. Under Yeltsin, you had the growth of these oligarchs, and it was very refreshing that they called themselves oligarchs in a way that our oligarchs here don't do. I think the interesting one more recently is Khodorkovsky, who apparently had most of the oil of Siberia under his control, and he was about to sell it off to the U.S. and the British. Zhirinovsky had, Khodorkovsky had become fascinated with Berlusconi of Italy, and his argument, of course, Berlusconi, a member of the P2 Lodge and a U.S. CIA asset going way back. Khodorkovsky's theory was the richest man in the country ought to be the president. I'm the richest man in the country, therefore I kick out Putin and become the president.
Well, that's why he announced,
Had to tell him, look, you know, this is Holy Mother Russia and the Byzantine Empire is here, and you're not going to become the president of the country. I think it you have to look at, you know, putting the richest man of the country in jail and keeping him there for a year now is an intriguing, maybe refreshing kind of thing to contemplate. I would say, though, that after the 1999 essentially was the Anglo-Americans saying to the Russians, we're going to bomb Serbia and there's nothing you can do about it. We dare you to respond. And the Russians, again, they did play that little trick at Pristina Airport that could have turned into something very, very ugly. Then we have the Kursk that we've mentioned. And then 9/11. Now, the Russians, of course, Putin on 9/11, and in the weeks and months thereafter, went out of his way to become Bush's great friend. It was a new era of U.S.-Russian relations. It was going to be sweetness and light. I would say that is simply a desperate war avoidance maneuver by Putin. Putin, of course, is a KGB operative. He looks at 9/11, and he knows, of course, as indeed many Russian officers said at the time, the official version is hogwash. I think we had the head of the Russian Air Force coming out and saying, this is simply impossible. Even here in Russia, where I have, you know, inferior equipment, I can get up there with fighter interceptors, you know, right. within minutes.
Right. Those few stories about that, by the way, particularly intrigued me. And as you and other sharp observers of any major news event will always do, you watch the sidelines for the small stories that come and go. There's where you pick up valuable information.
So they know that the official version is hogwash. They know it's not Al-Qaeda. It doesn't come out of a cave. And they would have to say, well, at that point, the network that they've been dealing with since the U2 incident, right, when the
yeah.
U2 came down to blow up the Paris summit of 1960 and, you know, the Kennedy, they've been observing all these things. They know what this is. They know that, as they would put it, you know, the most aggressive circles of imperialism have the upper hand. And they look at the United States and say, this is a country run by madmen. The madmen have taken over the government. What we're going to do is war avoidance, and we're going to try to play for time. I think Putin's basic idea is that the United States is becoming weaker and weaker, and I think he's on good, solid ground with that. The industrial production, industrial potential in the United States is going down and down. The U.S. is now bogged down in Iraq. I think what Putin wanted was for the United States to attack other countries, not him. The United States has now spread its forces all around the world, stretched very thin. We've got a mutiny in the army. Would they accept orders to attack a new country? Anybody's guess whether they would. And in the meantime, Putin was using the oil income of Russia to try to rebuild the country to some extent and push forward with well, what can we call them? Beam weapons, sort of Star Wars technology, lasers.
It is said by many, Webster, that the Russians have never slackened pushing the outer envelope on the most advanced weapon systems that that we know about.
I think it's plausible. We have the Topol missile, which is probably one of the most advanced in the world. So Putin is essentially playing for time, but then he finds that the Anglo-Americans are coming after him with these Chechen surrogates. Now, the guy who claimed responsibility for the Beslan School is this Basayev. And in Europe, he is simply known as a CIA agent, and that's all he is.
Pretty obvious, huh? Okay.
Pretty obvious case. So
Hold on right there. We have to pause. We'll come right back in just a minute as we continue. I'm Jeff Rentz, and I invite you to my website at rentz.com, R-E-N-S-E.com. We have news for you from around the world assembled in one place, in a likely situation you'll find nowhere else. Back in just a minute. One segment left with Webster Griffin Tarpley. I think we should kind of spin the globe a third of the way around and look at communist China. If communism is really what they're doing over there, it's simply an oppressive dictatorship with long roots.
Let's just another couple of things on Russia.
Yeah, I was going to try and tie them together. Go ahead.
I think the important thing about Russia is something like this. Putin and the Russian ruling elite look at the neocons and Bush, and they can see that these people are incompetent and that they're likely to get the U.S. into a wider war in the Middle East.
Right.
In other words, the logic of the Russian position is don't attack us first, attack somebody else first. Let it be Syria. Let it be Iran. Let it be Cuba. Let it be North Korea. Get yourself weakened by having to deal with them so that if you finally get around to us, you'll be bled to death and much weaker.
And this weakening, if I might interject this, folks, as you survey the news and watch, when you see the story that we ran, thousands and thousands of American men over the age of 50 are being forced back into the army and sent to Iraq. That's the kind of weakening that we're talking about here.
Absolutely. And you look at the mortality rate among master sergeants and non-coms, the backbone of a force in Iraq. Here's the other thing, that the Russians think that a Kerry administration might be adventurous in a more intelligent way.
Right.
In other words, the Russians look at the neocons and they say, well, the neocons are obsessed with Israel. They're going to be occupied in the Middle East for some years more.
Myopic.
And therefore they'll get bogged down probably in Iran. That would probably be the end of the U.S. if the neocons get their wish and go into Iran sometime in December or January.
Mm-hmm.
The Russians look at Holbrooke, Richard Holbrooke, as a possible Secretary of State with Kerry. And I think I've seen intelligence reports that there's a mood in the Russian officer corps that if Holbrooke gets control of U.S. foreign policy, then war between U.S. and Russia will become inevitable more or less in the short run. Because notice, Putin came out and lambasted the U.S. and the British for backing Chechen terrorism and the school massacre. Which
he had to be enraged. He had to be enraged.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's Holy Mother Russia and so forth.
Right.
The response of the Anglo-Americans to that has been to discover that Putin is a tyrant, that he oppresses people. The Washington Post especially is hysterical
mm-hmm.
about Putin. They want
mm-hmm.
him out. They want sanctions. They want
mm-hmm.
they want him out yesterday. And the notion is that Holbrooke would come in with a kind of a Jimmy Carter human rights interference in Russian affairs that would lead towards a confrontation.
Uh-huh.
Remember that Holbrooke is the mad bomber of Kosovo and Serbia. Right? He's the one who went to Milosevic and said, you're oppressing these Kosovars. We're going to bomb you, and you better give in. And Milosevic said no. Obviously, the Serbs, their whole national identity is they resisted the Nazis. They resisted Stalin. They're not going to give in to some Wall Street investment banker. But then, they were bombed, and the Russians were finally able to mediate. But that was a proxy war where the Serbs were getting pummeled so the U.S. could intimidate the Russians. And I think the Russians feel that if Holbrooke now comes back, because remember, he was part of the Principals Committee clique that seized control of the United States government when Clinton was weakened by impeachment in March of 1999 and insisted on bombing Serbia. And again, those bombs were really directed against Russia. I think there's a group in Russia that feels that if Holbrooke gets in, that will be World War III. And I hope that that Bush is voted out. But if Kerry comes in, we're going to have to go into a new mobilization against Holbrooke, who is a madman of a different type and perhaps more dangerous because he's a bit more of a realist than these neocons.
Well, I like the way you look both forward and backward to pull it together in the center. Very few are able to do that. That's a very important point.
Now, on China, I think briefly, China is also it's a target. And remember that the Samuel Huntington scenario is your main enemy. The two challenger civilizations that Huntington writes about are the Arabs and the Islamic world because of their demographics, that they're growing in population. And then you've got the Chinese with their economic growth rate. That's the threat from them, according to Samuel Huntington. The Chinese have been running 10 to 15% growth rates, the fastest in the world. They're not globalized. They're not free market. They're their own sort of dirigism or communism, whatever you want to call it. And they have been making rapid progress. I think they're making a lot of mistakes. I mean, choosing the U.S. model of internal combustion engines and private motor cars is crazy.
It surprised me. It's totally insane, and they're going to run out of petrol, and no question about it.
But the neocons see them as an enemy a little bit further down the road. Remember, though, the neocons actually started the big neocon project in the late 90s and into 2001 with the first months of Bush was to get a confrontation with China. And remember when that U.S. spy plane went down along the Chinese coast in the spring of 2001, Bush backed down. Right? He played it relatively cool under the influence of Powell and others. The neocons were screaming for all-out confrontation because there, too, the neocons have a kind of an awareness that every month that goes by makes the U.S. weaker and weaker and weaker, and the Chinese, with their 10 to 15% growth rate, get stronger and stronger and stronger. We've got growing trade deficit, growing federal budget deficit, growing immiseration up and down the line. The Chinese are actually making progress, and the neocons are going wild, saying we've got to move on now to new wars because we've eventually got to get around to China. So it's a pretty grim situation, and I think out of that mood, in early 2001, that's one of the psychological components of 9/11, because the neocons essentially say, we sat through 8 years of Clinton. He wouldn't take military action on the scale we wanted. Now we've got Bush, and he gets a chance for a confrontation with China, and he won't take it That's enough time for something big.
Remarkable. Very interesting. The Chinese, by the way, have sent 30,000 troops. It was 10, now it's 30. And they're stationed on the border with North Korea. You see that?
I'm not so much aware of that,
Yeah, we just got the update. They sent 10,000 troops a week ago or 10 days. Now it's 30. Supposedly to keep from being inundated with North Korean refugees. That's what the story is. I don't know if the North is ever to invade the South. It would seem like they're going to have to do it now or forever hold their peace or soon. And one wonders. The client state of the Chinese, North Korea, would it be allowed to be overrun and smashed by the neocons? Could they?
Well, that was the issue, back in 1950 and 1951, and it turned out they didn't want the U.S.
I can't imagine allowing the U.S. To achieve hegemony over that entire peninsula. I can't imagine it.
No, I guess you're right. Anyway, I think it's important to see 9/11 and indeed current politics in the phase that there's still a very real danger of all-out thermonuclear war coming in various forms. And given the fact that the world is now so chaotic, we're really in the maximum danger of October surprise right now.
And it won't be the discovery of bin Laden living in Beijing either.
No, but it might be an Israeli attack on the Iranian nuclear facilities.
And if they don't get them all, but we've had many guests on the program, and I do feel that the Iranians, and watching, well, diplomatic language is difficult, public statements, but I don't think the Iranians have one or two nuclear warheads. I think they have maybe a half dozen or more, maybe purchased on the old black market. I don't know. But the Israelis are rolling the dice. Now, their intelligence, of course, is supreme. It is said to be as good as any. But if they don't get them all, they're a small country. There's a big roll of the dice here.
And all you need to do is miss one. So
that's
I would say the lesson of all of this is that if there's one lesson of the 20th century in general, it's the absolute futility of war and the non-availability of military solutions to the main issues confronting humanity. And the quicker everybody learns this, the better off we're going to be.
Well, we should have learned it centuries ago, Webster, but we're no closer now, seemingly, especially with the advent of what we call modern technology, which makes it all so much more deceitful, devious, and actually technologically brilliant when you think about it, the potentials.
Well, that and neocon ideology, which is it shares with outright fascism, to which it's closely allied, this glorification of
sure
war,
does.
Glorification of violence,
that's
things
what is,
that I find absolutely revolting.
Well, they're beyond revolting. They're beyond words. The weakening of America. This is a real important theme you've touched upon. We need to watch this very closely. Both candidates saying there will be no draft. If there is no draft, the American military will be so weakened in a few years if it continues doing the bidding of the neocons, there won't be much left of it.
Right, and of course now we've had this mutiny. Let me just mention in the last couple of minutes, if people are interested in hearing a public event about this, I don't know if you're aware of it, but 9/11 Truth LA is doing a citizens' grand jury on Saturday.
I didn't know. Very good. I didn't know.
It's Figueroa and Washington in Los Angeles. It's from 5 p.m. to 11 p.m. I know this because I'm going. 911truthla.us, citizens' grand jury. Let's see. We have Jim Hoffman. We have Barbara Honegger. We have Christopher Bolin of American Free Press,
oh,
very
excellent.
Good journalist.
Excellent.
Don Paul and any number of films.
Very good. Well, Figueroa and Washington is a pretty tough intersection to miss, so anybody down there, that's an historic corner. 9/11 Truth LA.
9/11 Truth LA, and there's a phone number if I could just read it off.
Please.
It's 918-784-3623. That seems to be the information number. 818-784-3623. Mm-hmm.
Well, congratulations on attending. You'll make, I'm sure, an extraordinary contribution to it.
Thank you very much.
I think that when the book comes out, please consider yourself welcome. Come back again. Let's revisit this in light of what's happened. And things do seem to be happening at a very rapid pace nowadays. And if nothing else, Webster, it's not boring.
No, it's not boring. We have interesting times.
Thanks very much for being
Thank
here.
Thank you.
Okay. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Webster Griffin Tarpley and his new book coming out soon, 9/11 Synthetic Terrorism Made in the USA. info@progressivepress.com, and you can pre-order it now. Okay, that's hours one and two for you. We'll pause and be back.